going. We're obviously, okay, that's right. Meeting will come to order, right?
Okay. This is the meeting of?
This is the meeting of the Subcommittee on the Joint Permanent Rules.
Permanent and joint
rules. And permanent and joint rules. And we are missing a couple people. We're going to get started because Mr. Watson will be able to explain to us what we need to be doing and work us through it. And I'm assuming the other people will be joining us.
Madam Chair and members, you should have right before you a copy of the temporary rules of the Senate as they exist right now, including the changes that we made to Rule 9 on the committee makeup on the opening day. There's also in your packet a copy of the temporary joint rules that we adopted on opening day. So that's what we'll be working with, is to make changes to those two documents. There are suggestions for changes from Senator Betzold and Senator Pogemiller that have been reduced to writing and are ready to go. And if Senator Betzold,
I'm happy to. If in fact, Mr. Watson, if you wanted to distribute all three of mine, I can. Maybe we'll start with old 3-1 if you've got that, and then you can have the others distributed. Madam Chair, and hello.
Are you talking? No.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, the 3-1 is kind of a clarification of what we had determined not only last year, but it's my understanding previous years as well, too. And this deals with the motion to recall a bill from committee. We were involved with it last year on the same-sex constitutional amendment. Basically, a motion had been made once to recall the bill from committee. It had been defeated. Then it had been made again, and the ruling had been that it could not be made again, but we had to construe, I think, two different rules and part of Mason's to get there. And so this actually states the practice that if a motion has been made to recall a bill from committee, it's been defeated, it may not be made again while the bill is at the same stage. So that if the committee has not heard the bill and a motion is made and has been defeated, it cannot be made. However, if the committee has then heard the bill and voted not to recommend that it be passed, then it would be appropriate, it would be in order to make the motion again. Because, for instance, a member may decide, well, I want the committee process to work. I support the bill, but I want to at least see what happens in committee. If the committee decides not to take affirmative action, then the member may say, well, then I will now support the motion to pull out of committee. I think it's just so we don't have repetitive motions, because it could come up this happened on one particular one. I'm told it has happened in the past, and it could happen again. I think that if the body has decided to let the committee process work, let it work, and if there's been a change in the committee process, then it would be certainly in order to make the motion again.
Senator Betzel, just really quickly, I just talked to Senator Pogemiller, and I believe also his intent was that we get a chance to talk about everything today but not take any votes so everybody can go and think about it a bit, too. Yes, Senator Frederick.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, just a point of clarification. It says that this is to the temporary joint rules of the State and House of Representatives.
Oh.
Wrong heading.
It should just be the temporary joint rules of the Senate, right?
Yep.
Scratch the House. And joint. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sundin.
And Senator Betzel, I can see probably where you are on the marriage amendment on this one, but I'm also thinking, does this really serve the public good to give up the flexibility? Well, we may or may not have that flexibility depending on how you interpret Mason's, but I don't know. I'm a little hesitant about. There may be something that comes along that's truly in the public good, and you may want to move things forward,
sure,
and you may want to have that flexibility.
And certainly. And Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, of course, if it's the will of the body for whatever reason to pull a bill out of committee because people want it to be brought to the floor or sent to another committee, you know, the will of the body can do that. This prevents one member from repeatedly making a motion over and over, you know, about a bill when the body's already spoken to say, no, you know, we don't feel that the bill ought to be recalled this time, but the member persists in doing so. And I think that that can happen again and again. And I think that, you know, let's take it away from, you know, that particular issue. I don't think the body would be very interested in having, you know, any member trying to pursue one bill and saying, well, I'm going to make the motion again today and next week and the following week. I think if we've spoken, it's out of order. But, again, if at some point we decide, yeah, we are going to override the committee, which is a significant statement, you know, if the body decides to do it, they can. And I believe I wasn't here when it happened, but I believe that the guy that I succeeded in the Minnesota Senate, Senator Frank, had bottled up a bill on the Northwest Airlines terminal, and the body decided to pull it out and bring it to the floor. And they decided the committee chair, you know, was not going to bottle up the bill. So it has happened, you know, where the body has decided to recall a bill over the objections of the chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Wetzel, what would constitute the same stage in this rule? And let me make an example. Suppose a bill was going through two or three committees,
mm-hmm.
and let's just pick the Environment Committee. A bill was not moving an Environment Committee, and a member moved to take it out of the Environment Committee and refer it to another committee, but then it moved from Environment, say, to Judiciary, and the Judiciary Committee was not dealing with it.
Right.
And they had already made a motion, say, to remove it from the Environment Committee,
mm-hmm.
and now they want to make the similar motion to take it from the Judiciary Committee. Would they be this rule prevent them from doing that?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, I tried to use parallel language, which is in Rule 28.4 that refers to, and these are actually motions on the floor, that, you know, motions to postpone indefinitely, amend, may not be put at the same stage of the bill. Now, on the floor, it's a bit different process than in committee. When the committee has the bill, the committee always has the bill, and so they either have it or they don't. So what I try to get at here is the idea that if a bill has not been heard in committee, and a week from now it hasn't been heard in committee, and a month from now it hasn't been heard in committee, nothing's changed. However, if the committee has actually scheduled a hearing on the bill, taken a vote on the bill, in my view, something has changed as opposed to before. So, and that's why, as I say, a member may say, I support this bill, but I also support the committee process. So I am not going to vote to recall a bill until the committee's had a chance to work. But if the committee's taken a vote, and if I as a member disagree with that, what the committee has done on that bill, then I may vote to recall the bill because now the committee has changed the stage of the bill by giving it a hearing. It's still in committee, of course, so that hasn't changed. But the idea that something has changed within the committee process to maybe, you know, alter the status of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Well, Senator Betzold, with all due respect, I don't think we really need this because, and especially this for the next 4 years, you know, the majority's got even a bigger majority than they had in the past. And, you know, sometimes we deal with hot-button issues around here. They're inconvenient. They're difficult to deal with. Sometimes authors are trying to rev up the public support for something, and it takes a while to do that. And I always thought around here it never hurts. I mean, accountability is determined by voting. And you know, the smallest bit of respect you can give to the minority is to let them stand up and make motions. And you have the number of votes you need to defeat them every single time if you want to. But with this particular thing, you're suppressing debate, you're suppressing votes. And we can't really predict all the different dynamics that might happen on a given bill. You know, last year it was the marriage bill that, you know, I don't know what the next one might be, but But rules are, it always strikes me that the rules are intended to set out an orderly process, but also to be fair to both sides. It's, and in fact, in some ways, the rules are more important to the minority than they are to the majority.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, you know, and keep in mind, majority and minority can vary, not necessarily by political party, but on any issue. Member of the Senate can have an issue that the senator cares passionately about and is upset because the thing is bottled up in committee. You can certainly make a motion at any time to recall a bill from committee. It's in order. But, and I think Mason's is quite clear that, you know, to make dilatory, repetitive things when the body has already decided the issue is out of order. You can't have somebody, if you've lost, say, well, okay, I lost today, I'm going to make it again tomorrow, and I'm going to make it the next day, and so forth. I lost today, I'm going to renew it again next month, when nothing has changed. At some point, you know, and I think that, you know, what is consistent within both Senate rules and Mason's is that, you know, if there has been some sort of a change that would warrant, you know, renewing a motion, and it could be on the same day, fine, you can do it. But to have somebody who just loses a motion to then keep bringing it up, and there's not an obvious reason to do so, I think is a waste of the body's time. And it's not just, you know, the political majority it's any member of the Senate. I don't think the body would tolerate it. You know, I'd certainly be upset if, you know, a member of my caucus kept bringing up a bill issue over and over and over. I'd say, you know, knock it off. You know, we've decided that. You can certainly bring it up. If something changes, fine. You know, then that's in order. But, you know, it became crystallized with that one issue. But I'm afraid that, you know, other people may, you know, take the idea that it's okay to do that. And it wasn't. And the Senate ruled it out of order last year. And I think that, you know, we ought to just state it that that's what the process is.
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, let me just respond briefly to that. What changes isn't the status of the bill. What changes is the position of the members. And if you put this language in here, then we'd have to have a suspension of the rules, which takes what, three-fourths?
Two-thirds.
Yeah, two-thirds? Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you're in that phase where it only takes a simple majority, I mean, sometimes there are Maybe it falls one or two votes short of being pulled from committee, and three or four people change their mind. That's the difference. The difference is that you've persuaded a couple more members to bring it to the full body. It's not that the fact that the bill is at the same stage. And ultimately, it's the body that ought to have the control. I mean, if you put this in, it's also somewhat inconsistent because I guess you could argue it's a different stage if it's after a committee deadline. Because the first part of the rule already provides for two cracks. Mm-hmm. You can get a simple majority before deadline and 41 right after. But I think you're – where I would disagree with you is that the same stage isn't necessarily the bill. It's the individual member positions.
Chairman, Senator Betzel, the one high-profile issue to which you referred the last couple of years, I believe that motion was only made once last year. It certainly was not made repetitively. Maybe twice, my memory is.
Well, when,
you know, it was not, you know, there was a sense from all of us that, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't want to keep repeating that one motion.
Senator Betzel.
But when it was made the second time, it was determined that it was out of order. And in order to get it, and then we had an extensive floor debate as to whether it was in order or not. And it was pointed out, Rule 28.4 addressed part of it, but it didn't talk about recalling a bill from committee. We relied on Mason's. I think we had to construe two or three rules plus Mason's in order to get to that particular point, saying you can't do it. And as I say, if you take that one, okay, take the same-sex marriage issue out of the equation and put any other issue in there, and it's just something that somebody passionately cares about, do we as the Senate want one member to keep bringing up an issue, you know, more than once after the body's spoken on it. I don't know. You know, if we've said no, we're not going to call the bill from the committee. I agree, and that's why I wanted it worded the way it is, that there may be a change in circumstances to warrant renewing the motion. But just because a person wants to fill out a committee, you know, at some point you got to say, no, we're going to move on.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville?
The short answer, Senator Betzel, to your question is yes. Mm-hmm. If there's one crazy person who wants to do it every single day, they should have that right. And at some point, the public pressure will look at them and say, you're nuts, mm-hmm. if they really do that. Now, I've never seen that in my career, where somebody has done something so repetitively that they've marginalized themselves that much. Mm-hmm. But the body can easily marginalize without preventing them from standing up and making a motion.
Well, anyway, we're not going to vote on it. So
no, I was going to say.
I think we've fleshed out the issues.
That's what I was referring to, the persuasion of the other members of the Senate, you know, whether it be from a political caucus or other group of senators or the senators as a whole, you know, and some pressure to not do this kind of thing, too.
Madam Chair, I would just say, I think you take something away from the public process. I think we have to think long and hard about this one, and we will.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me move on to another one, Senator Betzel.
Sure. I had three of them. The other one was, next one, I guess, the 04 one. And I see this more as technical. The rules allow that the chair of the Rules Committee, with advice and consultation with the minority leader, can add or delete members from a standing committee. Doesn't say anything about budget divisions. What usually happens is that after every election we have a major reorganization of the Senate in a four-year term. In the third year there is sometimes some minor reorganizations, but we usually keep the same committees, the same structure. But every time we start a biennium, the names of the committee members are always published in the Senate Journal. That's the committee members, not the budget division. So this raises a bit of a question here. There's always seems to be in that second year of the biennium, there's members that, you know, want to adjust their committee schedule. I believe that the rule that we have here has been around for about 10 years. I don't know that it has ever been used against a member's wishes. Usually it's because a member wants to be changed, but there's always some modifications. And in fact, just last year we had three new senators who came into the Minnesota Senate, and they had to be assigned to things, including budget divisions. So I don't think that the rule has been clear as to whether or not the rule applies to budget divisions. And so I'm just suggesting that it's just so that nobody raises the question, because, you know, why was this person put on a budget division because the rules don't allow it? Well, let's do it. Now, again, the Senate Journal doesn't reflect budget division, so I think it's kind of a gray area as to whether or not we can do that. Again, I'm not aware of any situation where somebody has been forced on. I think some people have been put onto committees that they may not have wanted, but I don't know that anybody's been yanked off of a committee that they did not want to be taken off of. So I think that I see it more of a clarification.
Discussion? Next one.
The third one that I'm proposing, the last one, 6-2. At the end of the first year, the rules provide that any bill on the calendar, consent calendar, or general orders then be referred back to committee. It doesn't talk about bills on the table, and people are getting smarter, and I may have even done this once myself, where you realize, oh my gosh, we're getting towards the end, my bill's not going to be taken up, and I don't want to get it sent back to committee. Maybe very good reasons for not sending it back to the last committee, but so people are laying bills on the table, you know, right in the closing days of that first year, which could create a problem in the second year, because you got all these bills sitting on the table, and at any given moment, you know, any one of those bills can be simply brought up. It's just on the motion. I would move that Senate file X be taken from the table, and all of a sudden it's before us. And maybe that isn't if the idea is that bills we did not act upon in the first year ought to go back to committee, clear off the desk, and then bring them back up in the second year. I think that the idea of just laying bills on the table to avoid that process is sort of counterproductive. Now, I tried to, I worked with Mr. Watson, tried to think of some exceptions to the rule, and there's two that we probably need to be concerned with. If a bill has been vetoed by the governor and returned to the House of Origin, that bill's on the table. It serves no purpose to send that back to committee. It should stay on the table until such time that if it's a Senate bill, we take it up, or if it was a House bill and the House has overridden the veto and sent it over to the Senate, we tabled it, it ought to stay at the front desk. Or if the House and Senate passed a bill and we're in conference committee and we get to the end of the first year and we don't have the issue resolved, technically the conference committee is discharged at the end of at that first year, and then they would have to be reappointed or whatever. But sending that bill back to committee, again, makes no sense. It ought to just stay at the desk, and if it's the will of the Senate to go back to that conference committee issue in the second year, they're able to do so. But, and you know, there's another category of bills, too, that gets tabled, and those are the bills that are taken up usually on special order. They run into trouble. There's some amendments adopted. Somebody tables the bill. I believe Senator Pogamiller does not want to use a lot of special orders, but we may have to. And if a bill is tabled, well, maybe it, you know, there's a good reason to table it. Ran into trouble. Maybe we ought to send it back to the last committee and let them take a look at whatever the issue was, stall the bill, and then get it back to the floor. So anyway, I think that trying to clear off the front desk of the bills that don't really need to be on the table going into the second year, you know, that's the issue I'm trying to get at. So that's the proposal here.
Any discussion? Senator Neville?
Well, Chair, Senator Betzel, I had a couple of bills that were in this position. Yeah. The child support bill, for example, was one. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, I stood up and moved it back to committee because I knew it needed some fixing. But, you know, on the other side of the coin, if the committee has already acted on it and the author thinks it's still in good shape, why do we have to have an automatic rule to send it back to committee if it's already before the whole Senate? You were arguing kind of an efficiency argument, but mm-hmm. isn't it more efficient just to keep it on the Senate floor so that when the author is ready, he can just move to take it back off the table and move forward? I mean, we do consider a session to be 2 years, not one.
And Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I don't know the history or some of the rationale behind the reason for sending everything back to committee, and maybe Mr. Watson, Mr. Flavin can explain that. I was just looking at the rule as we have it that requires everything to go back to, you know, clearing off general orders after the first year, and then seeing that some people, you know, have been getting smart, you know, and saying, well, I better get my bills off of general orders and put them on the table. Otherwise, they're going to go back to committee, and then I got to bring them out of committee next year and bring them up. And I think that the stampede starts off in the last few days of every odd-numbered year where people realize that that's the process. And I think it's being abused. So that's the reason why I suggested it. But maybe somebody could explain the rationale for doing that, for sending the general orders and consent calendar and calendar back to committee after the first year, because that part, I don't know the history there. I was just trying to make everything consistent. Can anybody explain why we send everything back?
Mr. Flavin? And members, always coming up, my apology for being late. Something came up that I apologize.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, I believe the reason the rule was put in and written that way was the feeling was that if a bill had been sitting on one of the calendars for a long time and was not moved before adjournment, that there probably was something that needed to be done to it. And rather than leave it at that position so that it would pop up as soon as we reconvened in the even-numbered year, the idea was that if it had not moved, that the committee probably wanted to take another look at it. Since, you know, most members who get their bill that far to get it on a calendar would want to keep it moving if, in fact, they were happy with the bill or they sensed that the body was. And I think it was probably the other part of that is so that members wouldn't be surprised when they reconvene in the even-numbered year and all of a sudden here are these bills ready to go that they hadn't thought about for 7 months or whatever the interim might be. So it was a matter to let the committees take another look.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, there are at least three different things that happen to those bills that are, say, sitting on general orders in the interim. One is that many of them have been incorporated by floor amendment or otherwise into other bills that got passed. So they're just not needed anymore. The issue was taken care of in another way. The second is that other bills may have been enacted that changed the same sections that are in those bills that are still pending on the floor. So before they would be taken up again on the floor, they would need to be amended, redrafted to incorporate the amendments made by those other committees, by those other bills that were enacted. And the third kind of thing is just that circumstances change. The attitude of the public, the attitude of the members, the sort of the political dynamics, things are different after the passage of 6 months, 7 months, than they were in May. So members usually want to take a fresh look at those bills. So those are at least three of the reasons why it works well to just send all those bills back to committee.
Okay, but what would be left would be veto messages or vetoed bills would still be at the desk. And
conference committees
that have been reported but discharged.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just reading the rest of this rule, too. If a bill goes back to the committee and the chief author wants to pursue it again, at his at the chief author's request, it's priority among all the other committees.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of other problem areas with the language and the way it would have an impact on bills. One group of bills that Mr. Flavin may be able to tell us more about is bills that get laid on the table, Senate files that get laid on the table after the House file was taken up and amended to contain the Senate language. If that happens under Rule 45 as an automatic substitution, the Senate file is always indefinitely postponed. It's gone. But often I've seen it happen on the floor when it's a substitution by motion that the Senate file, instead of being indefinitely postponed, is laid on the table. Now, if that has happened to a bill, I don't think we would want that bill to be going back to committee because the House file it's been substituted. So we might want to refine our practice on those bills where there is a substitution by motion to indefinitely postpone the Senate file instead of laying it on the table. Now, maybe there are reasons why, in that circumstance, it has to be laid on the table. In any event, we should be taking a look at that. The other concern is the language on lines 9 and 10, unless otherwise provided for by motion before adjournment. And the usual motion that people have made is to take a bill off general orders and lay it on the table. So if they can't do that anymore, I wonder what would a person do to keep the bill on the floor? Is there another way to preserve it on the floor?
Well, besides suspending Rule 47.
Yes.
I mean, whether it says unless otherwise provided, even if you struck that language, if the body decided to suspend Rule 47, they could do that.
So I don't. I think it's superfluous language one way or the other because by motion you can do almost anything if you have a majority or supermajority to do it.
Mr. Flavin, any comments on the first point Mr. Watson was making there?
Well, usually, Mr. Chairman, the reason why they'd be set aside would be that we take the Senate language and put it on the House file and send it to the House because we want the Senate position. And the only reason that comes to mind right now as to why it would be laid on the table was that the Senate might want to preserve it on the table, easily taken up, if it wants to be used as a vehicle. If the Senate wants to use it as a vehicle to send another bill or an amendment that would be germane over to the House, it would be a ready vehicle to have that done. And I'm sure that we could find several examples of where that's been done in the past.
But you could, when you come back the following year, you can bring vehicles up to the floor. You don't need them sitting on the desk, on the table.
No, but I was trying to think of a rationale for, you know, Mr. Watson's point that sometimes, instead of being indefinitely postponed, the Senate file by motion would be laid on the table. And the first rationale that jumped to mind was the vehicle issue.
Senator Benson.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Flavin, Mr. Watson, when the House passes a bill, it almost does it really matter where the Senate companion is in the process? If the Senate companion is sitting back in committee, we're going to make the change, you know, to adopt the House file. It's just that Senate jacket that's sitting in committee is, for all practical purposes, dead, unless some way to use it comes up. But otherwise, we're going to operate off the House jacket. If the Senate bill is sitting on general orders when the bill comes over, well, apparently it gets tabled there at the front desk. But either way, we're not going to act on it. So it doesn't, to me, it doesn't really seem to matter. You know, if we send the bill back to committee, that's where the bill might have been, but for the fact that it got sent to the floor before the House passed it. So does it matter, you know, where the Senate jacket is? Why not send it back to committee? Why do you need to leave it at the desk?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, when we do a substitution on the calendars, mm-hmm. the Senate file is indefinitely postponed. It's gone.
Okay.
So those Senate files aren't available for use anymore. They aren't in committee and they aren't available. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of putting the Senate file, this would be by motion rather than on a substitution on the calendars, where we actually make the substitution at the desk because we want to turn the House file around fast and send it back because we all know it's going to conference. If the Senate file at that point is laid on the table, then it's available for use. The other Senate files are gone.
But again, at the end of the first year, we've substituted the House file.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to keep the Senate file at the desk, or, you know, can we? What should happen to it?
Oh, I'm not arguing.
Yeah. Okay.
You know that we should. I'm just saying that.
Okay.
Mr. Watson talked about why a motion would be made to lay on the table rather than to let the motion be indefinitely postponed. And, no, I'm not saying we should lay them on the table. We would rather have them either indefinitely postponed or
which committed. Which is what counsel suggested we might want to do.
Right.
Because it creates confusion with the two active bills and companions.
Sure. So, and indefinitely postponing means killing the bill.
Right. Why don't we have work on some language along those lines? That sounds like it's something we should clean up. We work on that language for later. Just going back to the 301, I get the impression that not everybody is thrilled with that one.
Okay. And Mr. Sheriff,
is there something we can do with that? Senator Benson, why don't you just articulate?
Sure.
What problem you would like to solve, and let's see if we can solve the problem in a way that makes people feel
it hasn't come up often. It did come up recently, but my concern, and this could happen with any member of the Senate who feels passionately about a particular bill and is upset that it's in committee and brings a motion to pull out of committee. The motion's defeated. I think it's fair to say that if a motion is made before the committee's had a chance to hear the bill and the motion's defeated, it should not be brought up again while the bill is still pending a hearing. Now, if something is changed, such as having the committee hear the bill and the committee votes against recommending its passage, I think it's fair to bring up the motion again because something has changed. You know, it's at a different stage within the committee process, because there may be a member that says, well, I support the bill, I want the committee process to work, but since the committee process didn't support the bill, I will support pulling the bill out of committee. I don't think that this and Mason's and Senate rules are quite clear that you don't want dilatory motions, people making repetitive motions. It's a waste of time for the body. So, even if somebody cares passionately about a particular issue, at some point, the body has spoken.
Okay, let's hear the. So, and why are people concerned about
Mr. Chairman, some of us feel that it should be the right of any member to make a motion like this.
Anytime.
And sooner, probably, rather than later, other members of the Senate are going to get tired of it and lend some suasion to, you know, to stop doing that. And if the member keeps on doing it sooner or later, probably sooner than later, the public is going to exert some pressure, you know, why are you doing this? And really that should be the reason that never be discouraged from doing that.
Okay. Were there other ideas that people were floating that we want to talk about?
Those are my three.
Minor.
Right. Three.
Yeah.
Yours.
Okay, let's pass them out. Senator, do you have something?
Well, I just, I don't have them. Maybe just a minute or two of discussion on a couple of items I just observed last night as I was going through. And maybe you can go to your full bill, to Section 8.2, which my recollection. My note has to do with commissioners. And just for purposes of general table discussion, I wonder if we could have some thoughts and maybe even some background history. It has to do with the appointment of commissioners and not reported by the Senate within 1 year.
Okay.
And it just seems to me that this process that we have ought to be able to act, a committee ought to be able to act on a commissioner. Well in advance of 1 year. I'm on page, page five.
Thank you.
And, I don't know what the time frame is. On my little note card, I happen to write, within 90 consecutive or 90 legislative days. But maybe just some thoughts and maybe some background about, why we suggest that a commissioner appointment can be bottled up, if you will, in committee for literally a year. That just seems to me to be excessive.
I agree.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Sanjum, the rule was put in place at the request of Senator Stevens. As I recall, the commissioner of DNR served 8 years and was never confirmed because Senator Lessard just would not give it a hearing. And I think there was some frustration that we ought to have an up or down vote, and the Senate agreed with that. I can think of a situation where the governor might make an appointment, say, in May of the odd-numbered year. And the Senate doesn't come back until March of the next year. So a whole calendar year may have already passed before we even get a shot at it. So I think we tried to make an adjustment figuring that, because we're only here part of the year, at least force us to make the decision within the year. So I think that was the sense of the Senate back then. It wasn't trying to actually we were trying to avoid the situation of having somebody serve 8 years without a confirmation, make an up or down vote.
Can't we tie it to legislative days or something, 90 legislative days or something?
Mr. President, these are just thoughts last night as reading. I just entertained it for discussion.
I'd be inclined to shorten that up.
It seems to me just to be excessive.
Senator Metzen?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, either do it or you don't. I don't think they should hang around forever. And if you want to shorten it up, that's fine with me.
What would be a way to shorten it up that would solve the problem Betzel just mentioned? Or is that the problem? Could we say number of legislative days or something? Or?
Which we don't, Mr. Chair, which we don't control. Of course, if the House burns off some days, those are still legislative days that are lost. And we have no
number of days of Senate in session. Is there a way to get at that? Let's think about it, Mr. Watson. See if next point. We'll try to come up with something.
Yeah, and the next one is, if that's controversial or not, at least the one I just mentioned. The next one would be on 10-2, and it has to do with what we just went through in terms of of developing our committees, and I've got to find it myself. Wherein the rules suggest in 10-2, which is on page 6, that the lines 10 and 11, the minority group shall transmit notice of its assignment to the majority group within 10 calendar days. I will tell you, and you were generous this year, Mr. Chair, that's just, it's kind of difficult, and I don't know what the right number is. I suggested with a pencil here maybe 14 or something like that, but literally if the majority ever took that seriously, but, you know, you send out your item to the members asking for committee input, and you get it back, you know, in a week, and you're really on a fast track, and, you know, 10 days is difficult. And I just, again, penciled in 14. 14 is still difficult, but it's maybe a little more reasonable.
Okay. That sounds reasonable, yeah.
Just one thought, Mr. Chair. I agree. I mean, everybody should have as much time as they can. I think this year it was done in record speed within a week or so, simply because most of the committees we had from last time, the committee chairs and so forth, carried over. So there weren't a lot of major change that were done. We had a lot of new members that came in that had to be slotted in both caucuses, but and adjustments in the calendar and so forth. But sometimes, you know, the job hasn't been done until, the reorganization hasn't been done until like late November, early December, you know, which is still plenty of time, of course, you know, before the start of the session. But it takes time on both sides to get it done. And if you have a really big organization, I don't think any of this, I think change at 14 days is not going to bump us into January, though. I think that there's still going to be time to do that. So extending the time is probably reasonable. It's just you don't want to go too far, because then you're at the start of the session.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it talks about 14 or 10 calendar days right now. You know, 10 calendar days, and, you know, we often don't get much done on the weekends and so on. It makes it difficult.
Or even more.
Yep. Other suggestions?
No, that's it.
Okay. Then I had a couple that I do I have a couple or just one? 108, I think, is just a cleanup amendment. Names of committees, right?
Right.
Mr. Watson? Is that passed out, 08?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's totally technical.
Yep. Mr. Chair, it just confirms the names of the committees referred to in the rule on sending bills to committee to the names that were agreed to on opening day.
Okay.
That'd be Anris.
Committee, yes. And then it just dawned the other day. Do you have some others?
Did you want to do
that? Okay. 07, let's pass that out. Well, let's pass all these out. Are these all ones?
This is conforming the language of statute by eliminating any reference.
Okay, why don't we just pass all these out and we'll go through them one at a time. Yeah, I'll pass this one out too. This would be in the joint.
The House doesn't want to make any change in that.
They don't?
There's no change.
The creative thing this month?
Thank you.
That's the current thought.
All right.
I change.
So let's look at the 07. Looked like this just conforms, Mr. Watson.
We got 09.
Mr. Chairman, again, this amendment just conforms the list of budget bills to the list of budget divisions that the Senate created at the start of the session.
Okay, then 09, Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, this conforms the language of the joint rule to the language of the new law enacted last year that creates a joint legislative committee of 20 members and gives it a little bit different responsibility. This simply takes out of the joint rule all the language about who is on the committee and how it operates. other than to keep the requirement that the roll call be viva voce.
Well, and then she's passing out the this wonderful new law we have to work with.
This, again, is a change to the joint rules.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, just on the issue, not on the rules we're talking about here, I'm curious what you thought of former Governor Anderson's suggestion that we chuck all of this formal regents selection and go back to members who would like to be regents going around and talking to legislators and going back to the old process. And as I recall, his argument was, well, there are good people that refuse to put themselves forward as a regent because they don't like the very public process and the humiliation or the degradation of their position in the community or the state of attempting to become a regent and being publicly turned down.
I thought both, just on a personal level, I thought both Governor Anderson and Governor Carlson are insightful on this. I think we have started to act a little bit like a DFL convention. And rules upon rules. All of a sudden, now we have a situation where constitutionally we can, under this law, this law says that we now can only basically select from names that are given to us by others. We can't bring names to the table ourselves. And if you look at the constitutional language, you kind of go, wow, that's a far cry from where this started. And so I guess, Senator Fredrickson, I was actually going to talk to Senator Senchin and some others about this. I certainly don't think we should have regent candidates wandering the halls lobbying members. And the way to avoid that is to have names before us that don't need introduction because they are of such stature that we know who they are. And I think that's the way the process used to work back before many of us. I remember when I first got here, names were kind of floated and suggested by leaders of the legislature and others, and all of a sudden those seemed to be the names in play. Then it kind of got to the point where everybody felt they had to go talk to every member, which I don't think is a very good system. But so I think we ought to repeal the law, personally.
But until we do, Mr. Chair...
Well, let's,
until we do, we
since we're in the Rules Committee, let's discuss that. Does the law prevent us from putting names forward at the convention?
Mr. Chairman, if you'll pull out your copy of the joint rules, you'll find it in, it's in your folder, in one of those little manila folders. Take a look at the last page, page 8. And it's rule 4.2. Should be right on there.
Page 8, 4.2?
4.2. And lines 19 to 20 say, or 17 to 21 say that the joint committee that's set up in that statute and recommends only people who have been recommended by the governor, it reports those people that have come through this gubernatorial process. Those persons are considered to be nominated. But then any member of the legislature may submit additional nominations. So you can make nominations from the floor, and then it proceeds. So under that statute and the current joint rules, you're not prevented from putting forward somebody else's name.
It just maybe it makes it a little more difficult.
Just have we adopted temporary joint rules, or are there?
Yes.
So
yes.
There are joint. Has the House adopted them also?
Yes.
Okay. And what does the Constitution say on this topic?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, the Constitution says that the rights guaranteed to the University of Minnesota are preserved. And the language that you're thinking of was the law that created the university before the Constitution was adopted, which has that procedure for election of regents by the legislature. And I forget what it says, other than that the regents are to be elected by the legislature.
And that's a law, not a constitutional provision?
It's a law, but it's enshrined in the Constitution in such a way that we can't take away any rights or privileges of the university that were granted in that law. It's sort of made it unamendable.
Can you find it real
least,
quick?
Huh? Yeah, it's in volume one of the statutes.
Anybody have any thoughts on regents right now?
That Mr. Chair, that first thing that Mr. Watson just mentioned was an act of Congress? No? Or
Mr. Chairman, there was an act of the territorial legislature. Let's see here.
I saw something in the statute books once, too, and it was my impression that the Constitution just trumped that then.
So while he's looking, Senator Frederickson, what do you think? You asked the question. I told you what I thought. What do you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe former Governor Carlson made a similar comment, didn't he? I think you have two governors from different parties, both of whom love the University of Minnesota. We ought to listen to what they have to say and make some investigation to see if we should make some changes.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, it is printed in Volume 1 of the statutes, just after the Constitution and before the Table of Contents. It's laws of 1851, Chapter 3, so that would have been a law enacted by the territorial legislature before the state was admitted to the Union. And the procedure on election, the members of the Board of Regents shall be elected at the present session of the legislature and shall be divided into classes numbered 1, 2, and 3. Class numbered 1 shall hold their offices for 2 years, class numbered 2 for 4 years, and class numbered 3 for 6 years from the first Monday of February, 1851. Biennially thereafter, shall be elected in joint convention of both branches of the legislature, 4 members to supply the vacancies made by the provisions of this section, and who shall hold their offices for 6 years respectively. Whenever there shall be a vacancy in the office of regents of the university from any cause whatever, it shall be the duty of the governor to fill such office by appointment, and the person or person so appointed shall continue in office until the close of the session of the legislature, then next thereafter, and until others are elected in their stead. And the constitutional language on the university, it says all the rights, immunities, franchises, and endowments heretofore granted or conferred upon the University of Minnesota are perpetuated unto the university. So anything that was granted in 1851 can't be taken away. Doesn't mean we can't give more to the university. We just can't take anything away.
Mr. Chair?
Senator?
Yeah. My first year as a senator, it was also a year in which there was a regent process, and for me, Dr. Patty Simmons, who was from Rochester, a Mayo Board of Governors person, chair of the Personnel Committee at Mayo, which is within that organization a pretty big deal, and she's a terribly competent person. I don't know if she's a Democrat or Republican. It never really mattered to me because I supported her based on her skills and her abilities, and they're profound, and I think she will be chair of the Regents next year. And so she's moved through that process very quickly, I think, just recognizing the Regents, recognizing the talents that she possesses. I don't know but for Patty Simmons, who hung her coat in my office that first couple of months, and I think literally probably touched every office within the legislature because that's what I told her to do. I don't know that she would have had the stature, at least publicly, to be elected, but yet I can tell you as a person, she's just an absolutely outstanding person who has and will serve the regions very well. So I don't, you know, the thing about, you know, politicking is, I think, somewhat important. She moved through the process, and I think as she moved through that process, she was able to demonstrate to all involved, people who never knew her before, that she was a talented person. But that all happened literally in maybe 3 months. And maybe she's different, you know. But again, totally unknown person publicly.
Might be an outlier.
Yeah.
Bill McElroy.
And I just look at the... All I know is the next three regents we pick are going to be there when we pick a new president of the university, probably. The odds are.
And Mr. Chairman, we have picked some very good regents, I think, but they've also gone through some long, tortuous process. Patty Simmons' predecessor, Dr. O'Neill, actually hung his coat in my coat closet for, I don't know, 3-4 months. You know, I don't know how he took time from his specialty at Mayo to do that, and I think he was a good regent. But I happen to have my office right next to Senator Cascaden, I believe. She was senator when she was running for regent. But, you know, we also heard that there are very good people of accomplishment who have looked at being a regent and were
exactly.
decided not to just because they didn't want to go through this process.
And some that did go through the process that arguably appear to be better qualified than some who come through the process. I suppose it would be shocking to all of us who are in a political atmosphere to think that the Regents Advisory Committee could be political. But if you look at how they vote and then start bullet balloting and stuff, it's pretty clear they're political too.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, maybe that's enough for now. But I actually was going
to apologize for
it. No, I thought that was very good because I was looking for an opportunity to talk about that a little because I think it'll come as no surprise that one of the districts that's being picked this time is the 5th district. Boy, we haven't had a very good string of what I would consider really, really top-tier regents from the 5th district. I'm sure I just got in trouble, but... I mean, you know, think about it. Walter Mondale lives in the 5th district. Wynn Wallen lives in the 5th district. I think Jim Campbell lives in the 5th district.
Probably.
I mean, I can sit here and pick off three people that I would go, gosh, they would be good regents.
Yeah.
And I suspect if members of the legislature sat and thought for a while, they'd go, I think Janet Dolan might live in the 5th district. I'm with you. Yeah. It doesn't matter to me if it's Democrat or Republican, because I think I just named two Dems and two Repubs.
Yeah.
I just want somebody who is more qualified to be on the Board of Regents than me. That's become my simple criteria.
Taking a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it narrows it a little bit, Senator Benson. I think it narrows it a little bit. Then I had one more that I wanted to just run by the committee for consideration. The subcommittee on committees has apparently in the rules is 5, and I don't know when that happened. So my first, has it been 5 forever, or does anybody know? Mr. Watson, how long has the subcommittee on committees been 5?
Mr. Chairman, I have not researched that. It's probably been forever. But maybe Mr. Flavin has a memory.
We can research it. I don't know if it's that important. I just...
Mr. Chairman, it's been a long time. There was a period when it was a standing committee, not a subcommittee of rules.
I see.
So I think five has been there quite a while.
Okay. Right. My only thought on it was, and five's fine, but it just... you look at the current makeup of the legislature and you go, well, should it be 4-1, 3-2?
Mr. Chairman.
And if it was 3, then it's pretty simple. You basically have the majority leader, the assistant majority leader, and the minority leader. And everything I know about the committee, it basically gathers to kind of make these conference committee appointments in the well. I served on this committee once. And the reality of the way the committee works is that the chair and the majority leader, with some input from the minority leader, kind of try to balance, make sure they got a good committee. This is also the group that historically has picked all the commissions and stuff, who sits on these commissions and stuff. So I arguably that could be a broader or should be a broader group. But so I don't feel strongly one way or the other. I just was throwing it out.
Chairman, I just think it works the way it is. I mean, five has worked over the years. It's not a... I think it concentrates too much on fewer people. They get the boards and commissions and other things. There should be a little more input than 3 people in the Minnesota Senate. It just seems like the process has worked very well, and I put on the thing, and I don't see a problem with it, so... Why change something if it's there's a problem? I could see it, but there's not been a problem.
Okay, so that one for people to think about. Other things that people have thoughts on,
Mr. Chair. Just an issue that came up yesterday. You expressed some concerns about bill resolutions, thinking that they should go to the Rules Committee. Is that something that you are interested in pursuing?
I'm sorry.
Bill resolutions ought to go to
the
Rules
Committee. Oh, yes, I thought we were going to draft something on that. We had the 2 Uyghur resolutions on the floor. I just wonder if we shouldn't have a rule that just says that stuff automatically comes to rules.
Mr. Chairman, our rule on bill referrals is relatively brief, and it doesn't have a lot of requirements on where bills will go. It says finance bills have to go to the Finance Committee, and GovOps bills have to go to GovOps, but... There's not a lot more than that. We don't say the tax bills have to go to the Tax Committee, and we don't say the constitutional amendments have to come to the Rules Committee, but they do as a matter of practice. So
except,
the question of how detailed do you want to get in that rule?
Except, Mr. Chair, we just amended the one rule, 4.5, saying that if certain things come out of committees that have certain things in them, we want to see them.
6 isn't even...
I was thinking that was the same thing. I mean, nothing prevents the Education Committee from processing resolutions to the federal government, but is that something that should then go to the Rules Committee after it comes out of a committee before it goes to the floor? I think that was what...
That's what I was thought. I actually thought we had... That's what I thought we actually did.
I thought it was, too.
Mr. Chairman, we have had that practice at some times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
When the chair of the Rules Committee has wanted all those resolutions to come to the Rules Committee, he has just said they should come to the Rules Committee, and they do. But that's not always been the policy of the chair of the Rules Committee, and so sometimes they've just gone to the floor.
I think it was a good policy. Whoever did, Roger did that, and others didn't.
There was a time, Mr. Chairman, when Senator Moe very much wanted all those to come to the Rules Committee, and then there was a time when he...
Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson, would it be helpful to have it in rule? As if, for instance, we do delineate certain things that have to go to certain places and some things that have to go to the Rules Committee, as an example. Would it be helpful if we just added that to the Senate rules, saying bill resolutions coming out of committees have to... Or the Rules Committee.
Does it
complicate things or make it easier? Or?
I think it makes it easier, but let's have a straight-up discussion. We don't want to encourage these, do we?
No.
So isn't the best way to discourage them to let everybody know they come to the Rules Committee? Same. It worked when we did the GovOps thing, when we said all bills that create new commissions have to go to GovOps. A lot of people stopped creating new commissions.
Mr. Chairman, I feel that would be a good process that we have to come to the Rules Committee before they...
Why don't we draft that then? Mr. Flavin, did you want to add anything?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to suggest if you do it, it might be good to put some language at the end of 6.1 because I think that's what you're addressing. Memorial resolutions to the President, the Congress, Department or Officer of the U.S., that kind of thing, I think is what you're after.
Right.
Does that make sense there? Whatever. Wherever Mr. Watson thinks we should put it. I want to make clear I'm not looking to influence that other than to discourage them. Because it...
And lose our clout in Congress.
Lose our clout in Congress. So...
Any ever been looked at?
Let me update you on our discussions with the House on deadlines. We're having a quality discussion. There's been suggestions to have. I'll say this broadly so that nobody, you don't know where the suggestions came from and stuff, but. There's been suggestions that maybe we need a conference committee deadline, public deadline that we agree to. That would kind of be a fourth deadline. There's been suggestions to have the policy deadline after the finance deadline because the business of the first term is actually finance bills. And there is a hope that the whatever we do with all the other deadlines, that there will be a deadline of April 3rd, which is the day prior to Easter and Passover. That would be the day we would leave for Easter Passover, that all the finance bills, omnibus bills, and the tax bill would be off the Senate floor. I'm seeing a lot of nods. My sense of that is if we were able to do that, then we could have orderly conference committees and clearly get out of here in a timely fashion. You wouldn't have this big rush of not quite knowing what was in the bills and stuff. And one of the reasons for trying to get the policy deadlines after the omnibus bills is so you don't have this incredible rush where just to meet the deadline, committees move bills. And my sense is it really has deteriorated the quality of committee work on policy bills. I don't know if that's a direct correlation, but it seems like it might be. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? It just seems like it. Because Mr. Watson reminded me that we've always had deadlines. I didn't know we had deadlines when I first got here. But apparently what we've been doing is moving the deadlines earlier and earlier to solve the problem of not getting the work done. And the net effect of that, it appears, is to been to decrease the quality of the work because committees haven't had time to do their work. It appears. Any thoughts on that, members?
Mr. Chairman, so your discussions have been to have the omnibus budget bills before the deadline, before the policy bills.
Yes.
Before the deadline for the policy bills. One positive result of that, I think, would be there'd be less pressure and less likelihood to be put policy into the omnibus bills because the policy bills would still be moving, and they still have hope of getting them through. And I don't think there'd be the rush and process to be putting the policy bills into the budget bills because the budget bills the last ship leaving the pier.
Right. Exactly. Excellent point. Senator Betzel?
The concern I've had all along, of course, is that if we didn't have deadlines, things wouldn't get done. You have to have deadlines, obviously, and I think we all agree on that. And the trouble is people procrastinate, the members, the lobbyists, the interest groups, whatever. So wherever you set that policy deadline, whether it's early or late, it isn't that we do more quality work in committees. It's that people suddenly look down and say, oh, my gosh, the deadline's coming up. I better get my bills introduced. And they get their bills introduced, and, oh, my gosh, I've got to get hearings on them. It's got to go to three committees. And, oh, my gosh, I can't make these three committees, so I'll just amend it onto something else and so forth. I think we'd have to change the culture of this place, and it's going to be hard to do, but basically say, get your bills in on time, or we'll see you next year. There's no reason why people are running in the middle of March, dumping a whole bunch of bills in, and then freaking out that they're not getting hearings when you say, okay, what are you doing January, February?
What drives us going home? What is the one thing we have to do before we...
The budget.
Isn't that, if you switch this, doesn't that become the moderator on that? Because we're going home. These conference committees on the budget are done. We're going home. And one of the things I think appears to be a problem is that we don't spend as much time on the budget during the first 2 months because we're spending so much time to meet that policy deadline. And so our most senior, best members are tied up talking about stuff that may or may not have to happen this year, whereas we do know the budget has to happen. So at least in the first year, it seems like you should have the budget bills first, because that is the business of the legislature.
Question, but Mr. Chair, then, but by pushing up the budget deadline, does that shortchange your budget committee process? You know, they've got
2 months.
They'll have less time.
The current situation is this year. The governor's going to put out his budget, I believe, Monday. So the April 3rd date is 2 months and 1 week. Do we need 2 months and 1 week to put together a budget? I'm not sure we do.
Mr. Chair.
That seems plenty. Let me put it this way. That seems like plenty of time to do it.
Mr. Chairman, but in some of the budget divisions, we end up hearing virtually every little bill that's been introduced to spend money, and we'll spend day after day, week after week, listening to those small bills when everybody around that table knows that there's not going to be enough money to fund all of these, even if we wanted to.
So how does that get fixed?
And some of us don't want to. So there's two sides of that. One, a member introduced a bill to do something good in their district. They invite the folks in. They make their presentation. When most of us around the table know that there's not going to be money to fund that proposal. Now, that's one side of it. The citizens have had their ability to come in and make their case to the legislature. But on the other, it's a little deceptive because the reality is there's not going to be money to fund it. So are we leading them on knowing that they're not going to get funded? And the chairman has not said no. You're knowing, should the chair be saying and the committee saying, we don't have money for all these, you know, folks. There's no hope of being funded. You know.
I think members know my preference. I heard all bills, but I also voted on all bills when I was a chair. And people got the impression real quick that if they were asking for something that just wasn't going to happen, we weren't going to spend 2 hours on their bill. We just voted it down. And what it did, at least in K-12, it backed up the process so people stopped introducing bills that were just outrageous because they knew they were going to get voted down. And it seems to me, and I'm not suggesting that every chair do that, chairs can do what they want, but I'm saying as a whole Senate, we got a little quicker to the point where people knew what was real and what wasn't. Wouldn't it make the whole process work better? You'd spend less time listening to things that weren't going to happen. If you were only in committees doing things that actually might happen, committees would be fuller. Seems to me the whole place would work better.
Sure, I agree with you.
I like the flip-flop, but I like exactly what you're talking about. You can get their work done in 2.5 months. I've been on a finance committee for 20-some years, so.
And it would then free up the policy committees
absolutely.
To spend time on whatever. And
you don't have the game playing, Mr. Chairman, like you'd slip this into that.
Mr. Chairman, what I described happens in division. I've never seen that happen in a full committee. You know, eventually when the division gets down to making up their bill, those proposals just fall by the wayside.
We have 1, 2, 3 on the full finance committee? 4? How many of you? 3 of you are on the full? 4 of you? You also? Well, your full finance is supposed to clean those bills out. That's why you're so small. Clean them out.
But it's done in the division, that's the problem.
Right, but if the division makes a mistake,
oh, yeah.
You could clean it up. That's kind of the idea there, the more senior members trying to modulate the process a little bit, just say, oh, that's a great bill, but maybe that should go separately, not part of the finance bill, because it's really not. Fine. I think this region process came in the finance bill, if I'm not mistaken. I might be mistaken. Or did that come in that big ed policy bill?
I don't remember.
We're in session anyway.
Well, let's we'll get together. Do we have another meeting scheduled to nail this, the rules down? Early next week sometime? And talk among yourselves if there's other things we want to consider. We had sent out a memo to everybody saying who's got any ideas.
I was thinking of redrafting my priority bill, but, you know, I've tried about four times and haven't gotten a very warm reception. But what do you think? Should I
wait. Yeah.
Even draft it?
What, okay. You know, one thing let me throw out, and I'm sure this is, I don't know, we should not only not add authors, we should also get rid of clones. Wouldn't that make a bill, when it's introduced, more serious? And people would then spend more time figuring out who the author should be rather than, oh, everybody can be an author.
Mr. Chair, define clone. I mean, if they change a couple of words and a couple of things.
At least they'd have to do that.
Yeah, they would.
At least they'd have to do that, which would mean some thought.
Yeah.
But maybe that's too radical. Does anybody here want to add, say we can have more than five authors? You do, Tom.
I think that would be a good thing.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
And why is that?
Well, it prevents clones. I think if you can introduce...
No, then you're going to have a clone to put...
I think if you could introduce a bill with 30 authors, that sends them a pretty strong message.
Just like in Congress, right?
Well, or in the... What does the House allow? 35? So.
I just heard Congressman Ramstead, and not to pick on him, he's just an example, I get along with him, saying that he thinks they're going to be able to pass this mental health thing that he and Wellstone have been working on now that the Democrats have taken over. And during that discussion, he mentioned that he was always stunned because there was apparently over a majority of the House are authors of that bill, but that the leadership wouldn't let the bill become law. I just sat there and I thought to myself, well, if the majority of the votes are there as authors, one of two things is happening here. Maybe they're not all that serious, those people who signed the bill. Maybe they just want to say they're for it. That's the part that I get concerned about if we start adding authors. And that's my impression of what happens in the House now.
We do that with clone bills here.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Flavin is familiar with this issue from years back. And I did pull out of my file a little table that showed the number of bill introductions from 1991 through 2002 and showed that the number of introductions has not been reduced by having an unlimited authors or 35 authors in the House. There are still duplicate bills in the House, and the number of author add-ons have increased dramatically. There are just, well, dozens and dozens of motions every year to add names to bills. They spend a lot of space in the House Journal just adding names. Now, maybe we should bring this up to date for 03, 04, 05, 06, but the statistics were pretty clear the last time we took a look at this, that it does not reduce the number of clones or the number of bills introduced.
What pace are we on now in terms of introductions? Doesn't seem like we've had that many.
Seems slow.
Who's our pace expert, Colleen?
We're at 154, which is way low.
Do we have a lot of clones or not?
Not really.
Yeah. Not yet.
Not yet?
We don't know where they all are.
Okay, next week sometime we'll get together. And thanks, and again, I apologize for being late today. Mm-hmm. Meeting adjourned.
Okay. What are we doing on the floor?
I don't know. What are we doing on the floor?
We've got a calendar.
We got the one calendar item. Where are you guys on that?
We're going to go over in caucus right now.
Okay. Let me know.
Try to make it work.
Okay.
You've got a piece of
okay.
Oh, are we going to do...
Inflation.